the difference between revenue and profit, and some other rudimentary facts about what I now knew to call the private sector, we were shipped off to our designated offices around the world, where we would join teams of other consultants and be matched up with corporate clients to solve whatever problems they threw our way. I soon learned that McKinsey's basic business proposition is straightforward. For a very large sum of money per month, companies can hire a McKinsey team to solve problems too thorny to be solved by the folks who are already working on them. At the end of this engagement, as it was called in the firm, we were supposed to produce a report that was dramatically more insightful than anything they could have generated in-house. It occurred to me, as I was putting together slides summarizing bold, sweeping recommendations for a multi-billion-dollar medical products conglomerate, that really, I had no idea what I was talking about. There were senior consultants on the team who may have known more, but there were also more junior consultants who, having just graduated from college, surely knew even less. Why hire us then at such an exorbitant cost? Well, for one thing, we had the advantage of an outsider's perspective, untainted by insider politics. We also had a method for solving business problems that was hypothesis and data driven. There were probably lots of good reasons CEOs brought in McKinsey, but among them, I think, was that we were supposed to be sharper than the people who were already on site. Hiring McKinsey meant hiring the very best and brightest, as if being the brightest also made us the best. According to the War for Talent, the companies that excel are those that aggressively promote the most talented employees, while just as aggressively culling the least talented. In such companies, huge disparities in salary are not only justified, but desirable. Why? Because a competitive winner-take-all environment encourages the most talented to stick around, and the least talented to find alternative employment. Duff McDonald, the journalist who's done the most in-depth research on McKinsey to date, has suggested that this particular business philosophy would be more aptly titled The War on Common Sense. McDonald points out that the companies highlighted in the original McKinsey report as exemplars of their endorsed strategy didn't do so well in the years after that report was published. Journalist Malcolm Gladwell has also critiqued the war for talent. Enron, he points out, epitomized the talent mindset approach to management advocated by McKinsey. As we all know, the Enron story doesn't have a happy ending. Once one of the largest energy trading companies in the world, Enron was named America's most innovative company by Fortune magazine 6 years in a row. Yet, by the end of 2001, when the business filed for bankruptcy, it had become clear that the company's extraordinary profits were attributable to massive and systematic accounting fraud. When Enron collapsed, thousands of its employees, who had no hand at all in the wrongdoing, lost their jobs, health insurance, and retirement savings. At the time, it was the largest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. You can't blame the Enron debacle on a surfeit of IQ points. You can't blame it on a lack of grit either. But Gladwell argues convincingly that demanding Enron employees prove that they were smarter than everyone else inadvertently contributed to a narcissistic culture with an overrepresentation of employees who are both incredibly smug and driven by deep insecurity to keep showing off. It was a culture that encouraged short-term performance but discouraged long-term learning and growth. The same point comes through in the post-mortem documentary on Enron called, appropriately enough, The Smartest Guys in the Room. During the company's ascendancy, it was a brash and brilliant former McKinsey consultant named Jeff Skilling who was Enron's CEO. Skilling developed a performance review system for Enron that consisted of grading employees annually and summarily firing the bottom 15%. In other words, no matter what your absolute level performance, if you were weak relative to others, you got fired. Inside Enron, this practice was known as rank and yank. Skilling considered it one of the most important strategies his company had, but ultimately it may have contributed to a work environment that rewarded deception and discouraged integrity. Is talent a bad thing? Are we all equally talented? No and no. The ability to quickly climb the learning curve of any skill is obviously a very good thing, and like it or not, some of us are better at it than others. So why then is it such a bad thing to favor naturals over strivers? What's the downside of television shows like America's Got Talent, The X Factor, and Child Genius? Why shouldn't we separate children as young as 7 or 8 into two groups? Those few children who are gifted and talented, and the many, many more who aren't. What harm is there, really, in a talent show being named a talent show? In my view, the biggest reason a preoccupation with talent can be harmful is simple. By shining our spotlight on talent, we risk leaving everything else in the shadows. We inadvertently send the message that these other factors, including grit, don't matter as much as they really do. Consider, for example, the story of Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott's office is just 2 doors down from mine, and he's a lot like the other academic psychologists I know. He spends most of his waking hours reading, thinking, collecting data, doing statistics, and writing. He publishes research in scientific journals. He knows a lot of polysyllabic words. He has degrees from Carnegie Mellon, Cambridge University, and Yale. He plays the cello for fun. But as a child, Scott was considered a slow learner, which was true. Basically, I got a lot of ear infections as a kid, Scott explains. And that led to this problem with processing information from sound in real time. I was always a step or two behind the other kids in my class. So halting was his academic progress, in fact, that he was placed in special education classes. He repeated 3rd grade. Around the same time, he met with a school psychologist to take an IQ test. In an anxiety-ridden test session he describes as harrowing, Scott performed so poorly that he was sent to a special school for children with learning disabilities. It was not until age 14 that an observant special education teacher took Scott aside and asked why he wasn't in more challenging classes. Until then, Scott had never questioned his intellectual status. Instead, he'd assumed that his lack of talent would put a very low ceiling on what he might do with his life. Meeting a teacher who believed in his potential was a critical turning point, a pivot from, "This is all you can do," to, "Who knows what you can do?" At that moment, Scott started wondering, for the very first time, "Who am I? Am I a learning disabled kid with no real future? Or maybe something else?" And then, to find out, Scott signed up for just about every challenge his school had to offer. Latin class, the school musical, choir. He didn't necessarily excel in everything, but he learned in all. What Scott learned is that he wasn't hopeless. Something that Scott found he did learn fairly easily was the cello. His grandfather had been a cellist in the Philadelphia Orchestra for nearly 50 years, and Scott had the idea that his grandfather could give him lessons. He did, and the summer that Scott first picked up the cello, he began practicing 8 or 9 hours a day. He was fiercely determined to improve, and not only because he enjoyed the cello. "I was so driven to just show someone, anyone, that I was intellectually capable of anything. At this point, I didn't even care what it was." Improve he did, and by the fall he earned a seat in his high school orchestra. If the story ended there and then, it might not be about grit, but here's what happened next. Scott kept up and even increased his practicing. He skipped lunch to practice. Sometimes he skipped classes to practice. By senior year, he was second chair. He was the second best cellist in the orchestra, and he was in the choir too, and winning all kinds of awards from the music department. He also started doing well in his classes, many of which were now honors classes. Almost all of his friends were in the gifted and talented program, and Scott wanted to join them. He wanted to talk about Play-Doh and do mental puzzles and learn more than he was already learning. Of course, with his IQ scores from childhood, there was no such possibility. He remembers the school psychologist drawing a bell-shaped curve on the back of a napkin and pointing to its peak. "This is average." Then moving to the right. This is where you'd have to be for gifted and talented classes, and then moving to the left, and this is where you are. At what point, Scott asked, does achievement trump potential? The school psychologist shook his head and showed Scott the door. That fall, Scott decided he wanted to study this thing called intelligence and come to his own conclusions. He applied to the cognitive science program at Carnegie Mellon University, and he was rejected. The rejection letter did not specify why, of course, but given his stellar grades and extracurricular accomplishments, Scott could only conclude that the impediment was his low SAT scores. "I had this grit," Scott recalls. "I said, I'm going to do it. I don't care. I'm going to find a way to study what I want to study." And then Scott auditioned for Carnegie Mellon's opera program. Why? Because the opera program didn't look very hard at SAT scores, focusing instead on musical aptitude and expression. In his first year, Scott took a psychology course as an elective. Soon after, he added psychology as a minor. Next, he transferred his major from opera to psychology. And then he graduated Phi Beta Kappa. Like Scott, I took an IQ test early in my schooling and was deemed insufficiently bright to benefit from gifted and talented classes. For whatever reason, maybe a teacher asked that I be retested, I was evaluated again the following year, and I made the cut. I guess you could say I was borderline gifted. One way to interpret these stories is that talent is great, but tests of talent stink. There's certainly an argument to be made that tests of talent, and tests of anything else psychologists study, including grit, are highly imperfect. But another conclusion is that the focus on talent distracts us from something that is at least as important, and that's effort. In the next chapter, I'll argue that as much as talent counts, effort counts twice. Chapter 3, Effort Counts Twice. Not a day goes by that I don't read or hear the word talent. In every section of the newspaper, from the sports page to the business section, from profiles of actors and musicians in the weekend supplement to front page stories of rising stars in politics, allusions to talent abound. It seems that when anyone accomplishes a feat worth writing about, we rush to anoint that individual as extraordinarily talented. If we overemphasize talent, we underemphasize everything else. In the extreme, it's as if deep down we hold talent in a higher place in our thinking than achievement. For instance, I recently listened to a radio commentator draw a comparison between Hillary and Bill Clinton. He observed that both are unusually good communicators, but while her husband Bill is a gifted politician, Hillary has to contort herself into the role. Bill is a natural, Hillary merely a striver. The unsaid but obvious implication is that she'll never quite be his equal. I've caught myself doing it too. When someone really, really impresses me, I might reflexively say to myself, "What a genius! I should know better. I do." So what's going on? Why does an unconscious bias toward talent persist? A few years ago, I read a study of competitive swimmers titled The Mundanity of Excellence. The title of the article encapsulates its major conclusion. The most dazzling human achievements are, in fact, the aggregate of countless individual elements, each of which is, in a sense, ordinary. Dan Chambliss, the sociologist who completed the study, observed, "Superlative performance is really a confluence of dozens of small skills or activities, each one learned or stumbled upon, which have been carefully drilled into habit and then fitted together in a synthesized whole. There's nothing extraordinary or superhuman in any one of those actions, only the fact that they are done consistently and correctly, and altogether produce excellence." But mundanity is a hard sell. When finishing up his analyses, Dan shared a few chapters with a colleague. "You need to jazz it up," his friend said. "You need to make these people more interesting." When I called Dan to probe a few of his observations, I learned that he'd become fascinated with the idea of talent and what we really mean by it as a swimmer himself, and for several years afterward, as a part-time coach. As a young assistant professor, Dan decided to do an in-depth qualitative study of swimmers. In total, Dan devoted 6 years to interviewing, watching, and sometimes living and traveling with swimmers and coaches at all levels, from the local swim club to an elite team made up of future Olympians. Talent, he observed, is perhaps the most pervasive lay explanation we have for athletic success. It is as if talent were some invisible substance behind the surface reality of performance, which finally distinguishes the best among our athletes. And these great athletes seem blessed with a special gift, almost a thing inside of them, denied to the rest of us, perhaps physical, genetic, psychological, or physiological. Some have it, and some don't. Some are natural athletes, and some aren't. I think Dan is exactly right. If we can't explain how an athlete, musician, or anyone else has done something jaw-droppingly amazing, we're inclined to throw up our hands and say, it's a gift. Nobody can teach you that. In other words, when we can't easily see how experience and training got someone to a level of excellence that is so clearly beyond the norm, we default to labeling that person unnatural. Dan points out that the biographies of great swimmers reveal many, many factors that contribute to their ultimate success. For instance, the most accomplished swimmers almost invariably had parents who were interested in the sport and earned enough money to pay for coaching, travel to swim meets, and not the least important, access to a pool. And crucially, there were the thousands of hours of practice in the pool over years and years, all spent refining the many individual elements whose sum create a single, flawless performance. Though it seems wrong to assume that talent is a complete explanation for dazzling performance, it's also understandable. It's easy to do, Dan explained, especially if one's only exposure to top athletes comes once every 4 years while watching the Olympics on television, or if one only sees them in performances rather than in day-to-day training. Another point he makes is that the minimal talent needed to succeed in swimming is lower than most of us think. I don't think you mean to say that any of us could be Michael Phelps, I said. Do you? No, of course not, Dan replied. To begin with, there are certain anatomical advantages that you really can't train for. And, I continued, wouldn't you say that some swimmers improve more than others, even if they're trying equally hard and getting the same coaching? Yes, but the main thing is that greatness is doable. Greatness is many, many individual feats, and each of them is doable. Dan's point is that if you had a time-lapse film of the hours and days and weeks and years that produced excellence, you could see what he saw, that a high-level performance is, in fact, an accretion of mundane acts. But does the incremental mastery of mundane individual components explain everything, I wondered? Is that all there is? Well, we all love mystery and magic, he said. I do, too. Then Dan told me about the day he got to watch Rowdy Gaines and Mark Spitz swim laps. Spitz won 7 gold medals in the 72 Olympics and was the big thing before Michael Phelps, he explained. In 84, 12 years after retirement, Spitz showed up. He's in his mid-30s, and he gets into the water with Rowdy Gaines, who at that time held the world record in the 100 free. They did some 50s, in other words, 2 lengths of the pool, just sprints, like little races. Gaines won most of them, but by the time they were halfway through, the entire team was standing around the edge of the pool just to watch Spitz swim. Everyone on the team had been training with Gaines, and they knew how good he was. They knew he was favored to win Olympic gold, but because of the age gap, nobody had swum with Spitz. One swimmer turned to Dan and said, pointing to Spitz, "My God, he's a fish." I could hear the wonder in Dan's voice. Even a student of mundanity, it seems, is easily lulled into talent explanations. I pressed him a bit. Was that sort of majestic performance something divine? Dan told me to go read Nietzsche. Nietzsche? The philosopher? What would a 19th century German philosopher have to say that might explain Mark Spitz? As it turns out, Nietzsche too had thought long and hard about the same questions. With everything perfect, Nietzsche wrote, we do not ask how it came to be. Instead, we rejoice in the present fact as though it came out of the ground by magic. When I read that passage, I thought of the young swimmers watching their icon Spitz exhibit form that almost didn't seem human. No one can see in the work of the artist how it has become, Nietzsche said. That is its advantage, for wherever one can see the act of becoming, one grows somewhat cool. In other words, we want to believe that Mark Spitz was born to swim in a way that none of us were, and that none of us could. We don't want to sit on the pool deck and watch him progress from amateur to expert. We prefer our excellence fully formed. We prefer mystery to mundanity. But why? What's the reason for fooling ourselves into thinking Mark Spitz didn't earn his mastery? Our vanity, our self-love, promotes the cult of the genius, Nietzsche said. For if we think of genius as something magical, we are not obliged to compare ourselves and find ourselves lacking. To call someone divine means, here, there is no need to compete. In other words, mythologizing natural talent lets all of us off the hook. It lets us relax into the status quo. That's what undoubtedly occurred in my early days of teaching when I mistakenly equated talent and achievement, and by doing so, removed effort, both my students and my own, from further consideration. So what is the reality of greatness? Nietzsche came to the same conclusion Dan Chambliss did. Great things are accomplished by those, quote, people whose thinking is active in one direction, who employ everything as material, who always zealously observe their own inner life and that of others, who perceive everywhere models and incentives, who never tire of combining together the means available to them, unquote. And what about talent? Nietzsche implored us to consider exemplars to be, above all else, craftsmen. Quote, do not talk about giftedness, inborn talents. One can name great men of all kinds who are very little gifted. They acquired greatness, became geniuses, as we put it. They all possess that seriousness of the efficient workman, which first learns to construct the parts properly before it ventures to fashion a great whole. They allowed themselves time for it because they took more pleasure in making the little, secondary things well than in the effect of a dazzling whole. In my second year of graduate school, I sat down to a weekly meeting with my advisor, Marty Seligman. I was more than a little nervous. Marty has that effect on people, especially his students. Then in his 60s, Marty had won just about every accolade psychology has to offer. His early research led to an unprecedented understanding of clinical depression. More recently, as president of the American Psychological Association, he christened the field of positive psychology, a discipline that applies the scientific method to questions of human flourishing. Marty is barrel-chested and baritone-voiced. He may study happiness and well-being, but cheerful is not a word I'd use to describe him. In the middle of whatever it was I was saying, a report on what I'd done in the past week, I suppose, or the next steps in one of our research studies, Marty interrupted. You haven't had a good idea in 2 years. I stared at him open-mouthed, trying to process what he'd just said. Then I blinked. 2 years? I hadn't even been in graduate school for 2 years. Silence. Then he crossed his arms, frowned, and said, you can do all kinds of fancy statistics. You somehow get every parent in a school to return their consent form. You've made a few insightful observations, but you don't have a theory. You don't have a theory for the psychology of achievement. Silence. What's a theory? I finally asked, having absolutely no clue as to what he was talking about. Silence. Stop reading so much and go think. I left his office, went into mine, and cried. At home with my husband, I cried more. I cursed Marty under my breath, and aloud as well, for being such a jerk. Why was he telling me what I was doing wrong? Why wasn't he praising me for what I was doing right? You don't have a theory. Those words rattled around in my mind for days. Finally, I dried my tears, stopped my cursing, and sat down at my computer. I opened the word processor and stared at the blinking cursor, realizing I hadn't gotten far beyond the basic observation that talent was not enough to succeed in life. I hadn't worked out how, exactly, talent and effort and skill and achievement all fit together. A theory is an explanation. A theory takes a blizzard of facts and observations and explains, in the most basic terms, what the heck is going on. By necessity, a theory is incomplete. It oversimplifies. But in doing so, it helps us understand. If talent falls short of explaining achievement, what's missing? I have been working on a theory of the psychology of achievement since Marty scolded me for not having one. I have pages and pages of diagrams, filling more than a dozen lab notebooks. After more than a decade of thinking about it, sometimes alone and sometimes in partnership with close colleagues, I finally published an article in which I lay down two simple equations that explain how you get from talent to achievement. Here they are. First, talent times effort equals skill. Second, skill times effort equals achievement. Talent is how quickly your skills improve when you invest effort. Achievement is what happens when you take your acquired skills and use them. Of course, your opportunities, for example, having a great coach or teacher, matter tremendously too, and maybe more than anything about the individual. My theory doesn't address these outside forces, nor does it include luck. It's about the psychology of achievement, but because psychology isn't all that matters, it's incomplete. Still, I think it's useful. What this theory says is that when you consider individuals in identical circumstances, what each achieves depends on just two things, talent and effort. Talent, how fast we improve in skill, absolutely matters. But effort factors into the calculations twice, not once. Effort builds skill. At the very same time, effort makes skill productive. Let me give you a few examples. There's a celebrated potter named Warren McKenzie who lives in Minnesota. Now 92 years old, he has been at his craft, without interruption, for nearly his entire adult life. Early on, he and his late wife, also an artist, tried a lot of different things. You know, when you're young, you think you can do anything, and we thought, oh, we'll be potters, we'll be painters, we'll be textile designers, we'll be jewelers, we'll be a little of this, a little of that. We were going to be the Renaissance people. It soon became clear that doing one thing better and better might be more satisfying than staying an amateur at many different things. Eventually, both of us gave up the drawing and painting, gave up the silk screening, gave up the textile design, and concentrated on ceramic work because that was where we felt our true interest lay. McKenzie told me a good potter can make 40 or 50 pots in a day. Out of these, some of them are good and some of them are mediocre and some of them are bad. Only a few will be worth selling, and of those, even fewer will continue to engage the senses after daily use. Of course, it's not just the number of good pots McKenzie makes that has brought the art world to his door. It's the beauty and form of the pots. I'm striving to make things which are the most exciting things I can make that will fit in people's homes. Still, as a simplification, you might say that the number of enduringly beautiful, exquisitely useful pots McKenzie is able to produce, in total, will be what he accomplishes as an artist. It would not satisfy him to be among the most masterful potters, but only produce, say, one or two pieces in his lifetime. McKenzie still throws clay on the wheel every day, and with effort, his skill has improved. I think back to some of the pots we made when we first started our pottery, and they were pretty awful pots. We thought at the time they were good, they were the best we could make, but our thinking was so elemental that the pots had that quality also, and so they don't have a richness about them which I look for in my work today. The first 10,000 pots are difficult, he has said, and then it gets a little bit easier. As things got easier, and as Mackenzie improved, he produced more good pots a day. Talent times effort equals skill. At the same time, the number of good pots he's brought into the world increased. Skill times effort equals achievement. With effort, Mackenzie has gotten better and better at making the most exciting things I can make that will fit in people's homes. At the same time, with the same invested effort, he has become more accomplished. Garp was a natural storyteller. This is a line from John Irving's fourth novel, The World According to Garp. Like that novel's fictional protagonist, Irving tells a great story. He has been lauded as the great storyteller of American literature today. To date, he's written more than a dozen novels, most of which have been bestsellers and half of which have been made into movies. The World According to Garp won the National Book Award, and Irving's screenplay for The Cider House Rules won an Academy Award. But unlike Garp, Irving was not a natural. While Garp, quote, could make things up, one right after the other, and they seemed to fit, unquote, Irving rewrites draft after draft of his novels. Of his early attempts at writing, Irving has said, "Most of all, I rewrote everything. I began to take my lack of talent seriously." Irving recalls earning a C- in high school English. His SAT verbal score was 475 out of 800, which means almost two-thirds of the students who took the SAT did better than him. He needed to stay in high school an extra year to have enough credits to graduate. Irving recalls that his teachers thought he was both lazy and stupid. Irving was neither lazy nor stupid, but he was severely dyslexic. "I was an underdog. If my classmates could read our history assignment in an hour, I allowed myself two or three. If I couldn't learn to spell, I would keep a list of my most frequently misspelled words." When his own son was diagnosed with dyslexia, Irving finally understood why he himself had been such a poor student. Irving's son read noticeably slower than his classmates, with his finger following the sentence, "As I read," Irving says, "as I still read. Unless I've written it, I read whatever it is very slowly, and with my finger." Since reading and writing didn't come easily, Irving learned that to do anything really well, you have to overextend yourself. "In my case," he says, "I learned that I just had to pay twice as much attention. I came to appreciate that in doing something over and over again, something that was never natural becomes almost second nature. You learn that you have the capacity for that, and that it doesn't come overnight." Do the precociously talented learn that lesson? Do they discover that the capacity to do something over and over again, to struggle, to have patience, can be mastered, but not overnight? Some might, but those who struggle early may learn it better. "One reason I have confidence in writing the kind of novels I write," Irving said, "is that I have confidence in my stamina to go over something again and again, no matter how difficult it is." After his 10th novel, Irving observed, "Rewriting is what I do best as a writer. I spend more time revising a novel or a screenplay than I take to write the first draft." "It's become an advantage," Irving has observed, "of his inability to read and spell as fluently as others. In writing a novel, it doesn't hurt anybody to have to go slowly. It doesn't hurt anyone as a writer to have to go over something again and again." With daily effort, Irving became one of the most masterful and prolific writers in history. With effort, he became a master, and with effort, his mastery produced stories that have touched millions of people, including me. Grammy Award-winning musician and Oscar-nominated actor Will Smith has thought a lot about talent, effort, skill, and achievement. I've never really viewed myself as particularly talented, he once observed. Where I excel is ridiculous, sickening work ethic. Accomplishment, in Will's eyes, is very much about going the distance. Asked to explain his ascendancy to the entertainment elite, Will said, "The only thing that I see that is distinctly different about me is I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill. I will not be outworked, period. You might have more talent than me. You might be smarter than me. You might be sexier than me. You might be all of those things. You got it on me in 9 categories. But if we get on the treadmill together, there's 2 things. You're getting off first, or I'm going to die. It's really that simple." In 1940, researchers at Harvard University had the same idea. In a study designed to understand the characteristics of healthy young men, in order to help people live happier, more successful lives, 130 sophomores were asked to run on a treadmill for up to 5 minutes. The treadmill was set at such a steep angle and cranked up to such a fast speed that the average man held on for only 4 minutes. Some lasted for only 1.5 minutes. By design, the treadmill test was exhausting, not just physically, but mentally. By measuring and then adjusting for baseline physical fitness, the researchers designed the treadmill test to gauge stamina and strength of will. In particular, Harvard researchers knew that running hard was not just a function of aerobic capacity and muscle strength, but also the extent to which, quote, a subject is willing to push himself or has a tendency to quit before the punishment becomes too severe, unquote. Decades later, a psychiatrist named George Valiant followed up on the young men in the original treadmill test. Then in their 60s, these men had been contacted by researchers every 2 years since graduating from college, and for each, there was a corresponding file folder at Harvard, literally bursting with questionnaires, correspondence, and notes from in-depth interviews. For instance, researchers noted for each man his income, career advancement, sick days, social activities, self-reported satisfaction with work and marriage, visits to psychiatrists, and use of mood-altering drugs like tranquilizers. All this information went into composite estimates of the men's overall psychological adjustment in adulthood. It turns out that run time in the treadmill test at age 20 was a surprisingly reliable predictor of psychological adjustment throughout adulthood. George and his team considered that staying on the treadmill was also a function of how physically fit these men were in their youth, and that this finding merely indicated that physical health predicted later psychological well-being. However, they found that adjusting for baseline physical fitness, quote, had little effect on the correlation of running time with mental health, unquote. In other words, Will Smith is onto something. When it comes to how we fare in the marathon of life, effort counts tremendously. How long would you have stayed on the treadmill? I asked George recently. I wanted to know because, in my eyes, George is himself a paragon of grit. Early in his career, not long after completing his residency in psychiatry, George discovered the treadmill data, along with all the other information on the men collected to that point. Like a baton, the study had been handed from one research team to another, with dwindling interest and energy, until it got to him. George revived the study. He reestablished contact with the men by mail and phone, and in addition, interviewed each in person, traveling to all corners of the world to do so. Now in his 80s, George has outlived most of the men in the original study. He is currently writing his 4th book on what is by now the longest continuous study of human development ever undertaken. In answer to my question about his own treadmill perseverance, George replied, "Oh, I'm not all that persistent. When I do crossword puzzles on the airplane, I always look up the answers when I'm a little bit frustrated." So, not very gritty when it comes to crossword puzzles. And when something is broken in the house, I turn it over to my wife, and she fixes it. So, you don't think you're gritty? I asked. The reason why the Harvard study works, George said, is that I have been doing it constantly and persistently. It's the one ball I've kept my eye on, because I'm totally fascinated by it. There is nothing more interesting than watching people grow. And then, after a short pause, George recalled his days at prep school, where as a varsity track athlete, he competed in pole vaulting. To improve, he and the other vaulters did pull-ups, which he calls chins because you start by hanging off a bar and then pull yourself up to where your chin hovers just above and then drop down again and repeat. I could do more chins than anyone, and it wasn't because I was very athletic. I wasn't. The reason is that I did a lot of chin-ups. I practiced. The prolific writer and director Woody Allen, when asked about his advice for young artists, once said, "My observation was that once a person actually completed a play or a novel, he was well on his way to getting it produced or published, as opposed to a vast majority of people who tell me their ambition is to write, but who strike out on the very first level, and indeed never write the play or book." Or, in Alan's snappier formulation, 80% of success in life is showing up. Back in the 1980s, both George H.W. Bush and Mario Cuomo frequently repeated this bit of wisdom in speech after speech, turning the saying into something of a meme. So, while these leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties must have disagreed on a great many things, they were in complete consensus on the importance of following through on what one has started. I told George Valiant that if I'd been on the Harvard research team in 1940, I would have made a suggestion. I would have allowed the young men to come back the next day, if they wanted, and try the treadmill test again. I suspect that some would have come back to see if they could stay on longer, whereas others would have been content with their first timed effort. Maybe some would ask the researchers whether they knew of any strategies, physical or mental, in order to last longer. And maybe these fellows would even be interested in a third try, and a fourth. Then I would create a grit score based on how many times men voluntarily returned to see if they could improve. Staying on the treadmill is one thing, and I do think it's related to staying true to our commitments, even when we're not comfortable. But getting back on the treadmill the next day, eager to try again, is in my view even more reflective of grit. Because when you don't come back the next day, when you permanently turn your back on a commitment, your effort plummets to zero. As a consequence, your skills stop improving, and at the same time, you stop producing anything with whatever skills you have. The treadmill is in fact an appropriate metaphor. By some estimates, about 40% of people who buy home exercise equipment later say they ended up using it less than they'd expected. How hard we push ourselves in a given workout matters, of course. But I think the bigger impediment to progress is that sometimes we stop working out altogether. As any coach or athlete will tell you, consistency of effort over the long run is everything. How often do people start down a path and then give up on it entirely? How many treadmills, exercise bikes, and weight sets are at this very moment gathering dust in basements across the country? How many kids go out for a sport and then quit even before the season is over? How many of us vowed to knit sweaters for all of our friends, but only manage half a sleeve before putting down the needles? Ditto for home vegetable gardens, compost bins, and diets. How many of us start something new, full of excitement and good intentions, and then give up permanently when we encounter the first real obstacle, the first long plateau in progress? Many of us, it seems, quit what we start far too early and far too often. Even more than the effort a gritty person puts in on a single day, what matters is that they wake up the next day and the next ready to get on that treadmill and keep going. If I have the math approximately right, then someone twice as talented but half as hardworking as another person might reach the same level of skill, but still produce dramatically less over time. This is because as strivers are improving in skill, they are also employing that skill, to make pots, write books, direct movies, give concerts. If the quality and quantity of those pots, books, movies, and concerts are what count, then the striver who equals the person who is a natural in skill by working harder will in the long run accomplish more. The separation of talent and skill, Will Smith has pointed out, is one of the greatest misunderstood concepts for people who are trying to excel, who have dreams, who want to do things. Talent you have naturally, skills only developed by hours and hours and hours of beating on your craft. I would add that skill is not the same thing as achievement either. Without effort, your talent is nothing more than your unmet potential. Without effort, your skill is nothing more than what you could have done but didn't. With effort, talent becomes skill, and at the very same time, effort makes skill productive. Chapter 4. How Gritty Are You? I recently gave a lecture on grit to undergraduates at the Wharton School of Business. Even before I'd cleared my notes from the podium, an aspiring entrepreneur rushed to introduce himself. He was charming, full of the energy and enthusiasm that makes teaching young people so rewarding. Breathlessly, he told me a story meant to illustrate his own prodigious grit. Earlier that year, he'd raised thousands of dollars for his startup, going to heroic lengths to do so, and pulling several all-nighters in the process. I was impressed and said so, but I hastened to add that grit is more about stamina than intensity. So if you're working on that project with the same energy in a year or two, email me, I said. I can say more about your grit then. He was puzzled. Well, I might not be working on the same thing in a few years. Good point. Lots of ventures that seem promising at the start turn out badly. Lots of optimistic business plans end up in the discard bin. Okay, I said, so maybe this particular startup won't be what you're working on. But if you're not working in the same industry, if you're onto some totally unrelated pursuit, then I'm not sure your story illustrates grit. You mean stay in one company? He asked. Not necessarily. But skipping around from one kind of pursuit to another, from one skill set to an entirely different one, that's not what gritty people do. But what if I move around a lot and, while I'm doing that, I'm working incredibly hard? Grit isn't just working incredibly hard. That's only part of it. Pause. Why? He asked. Well, for one thing, there are no shortcuts to excellence, I explained. Developing real expertise, figuring out really hard problems, it all takes time, longer than most people imagine. And then, you know, you've got to apply those skills and produce goods or services that are valuable to people. Rome wasn't built in a day. He was listening, so I continued. And here's the really important thing. Grit is about working on something you care about so much that you're willing to stay loyal to it. It's doing what you love, he said. I get that. Right. It's doing what you love, but not just falling in love, staying in love. How gritty are you? Let's go through a version of the grit scale I developed from my study at West Point, and which I used in other studies described in this book. You can find the grit scale on the PDF included with this audiobook, or on my website at angeladuckworth.com. I'll read each of the items in order. Don't overthink these questions. Instead, just ask yourself how you compare, not just to your coworkers, friends, or family, but to most people. Here we go. Number 1. New ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones. Number 2. Setbacks don't discourage me. I don't give up easily. Number 3. I often set a goal, but later choose to pursue a different one. 4. I am a hard worker. 5. I have difficulty maintaining my focus on projects that take more than a few months to complete. 6. I finish whatever I begin. 7. My interests change from year to year. 8. I am diligent. I never give up. 9. I have been obsessed with a certain idea or project for a short time, but later lost interest. 10. I have overcome setbacks to conquer an important challenge. When calculating your grit score, you add up all your points and divide by 10. The maximum score on this scale is 5, extremely gritty, and the lowest possible score is 1, not at all gritty. On the PDF included with this audiobook, you can view a chart to see how your scores compare to a large sample of American adults. 2.5 on the grit scale is about 10%. If you scored 2.5, you're gritty than only 10% of the adults in our sample. But if you scored 4.1, you're at the 70th percentile, grittier than about 70% of the adults in our sample. At 4.9, you're grittier than 99% of the American adults whom we surveyed. Keep in mind that your grit score is a reflection of how you see yourself right now. How gritty you are at this point in your life might be different from how gritty you were when you were younger. And if you take the grit scale again later, you might get a different score. As this book will continue to show, there is every reason to believe that grit can change. Grit has two components, passion and perseverance. If you want to dig a little deeper, you can calculate separate scores for each component. For your passion score, add up your points for the odd-numbered items and divide by 5. For your perseverance score, add up your points for the even-numbered items and divide by 5. If you scored high on passion, you probably scored high on perseverance too, and vice versa. Still, I'll take a guess that your perseverance score is a wee bit higher than your passion score. This isn't true for all people, but it's true for most people I've studied. For instance, I took the scale while writing this chapter, and I scored 4.6 overall. My perseverance score was 5.0, and my passion score was only 4.2. Strange as it sounds, staying focused on consistent goals over time is more of a struggle for me than working hard and bouncing back from setbacks. This consistent pattern, perseverance scores more often topping passion scores, is a clue that passion and perseverance aren't exactly the same thing. In the rest of this chapter, I'll explain how they differ and show how to understand them as two parts of a whole. While taking the grit scale, you might have noticed that none of the passion questions asked how intensely you're committed to your goals. This may seem odd, because the word passion is often used to describe intense emotions. For a lot of people, passion is synonymous with infatuation or obsession. But in interviews about what it takes to succeed, high achievers often talk about commitment of a different kind. Rather than intensity, what comes up again and again in their remarks is the idea of consistency over time. For instance, I've heard of chefs who grew up watching Julia Child on television and remained fascinated with cooking into adulthood. I've heard of investors whose curiosity about the financial markets is as keen in their fourth or fifth decade of investing as it was on their very first day of trading. I've heard of mathematicians who work on a problem, the same problem, day and night for years without once deciding, oh, to heck with this theorem, I'm moving on to something else. And that's why the questions that generate your passion score ask you to reflect on how steadily you hold to goals over time. Is passion the right word to describe sustained, enduring devotion? Some might say I should find a better word. Maybe so. But the important thing is the idea itself. Enthusiasm is common. Endurance is rare. Consider, for example, Jeffrey Gettleman. For about a decade, Jeff has been the East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. In 2012, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his coverage of conflict in East Africa. He's a bit of a celebrity in the world of international journalism, widely admired for his courage to pursue stories that put his life at risk, and also for his willingness to unflinchingly report events that are unthinkably horrific. I met Jeff when we were in our early 20s. At the time, both of us were pursuing master's degrees at Oxford University. For me, this was before McKinsey, before teaching, and before becoming a psychologist. For Jeff, this was before he'd written his first news story. I think it's fair to say that, back then, neither of us knew quite what we wanted to be when we grew up, and we were both trying desperately to figure it out. I caught up with Jeff on the phone recently. He was in Nairobi, his home base between trips to other parts of Africa. Every few minutes, we had to ask each other if we could still be heard. After reminiscing about our classmates and trading news about our children, I asked Jeff to reflect on the idea of passion and how it had played out in his life. "For a very long time, I've had a very clear sense of where I wanted to be," Jeff told me, "and that passion is to live and work in East Africa." "Oh, I didn't know. I assumed your passion was journalism, not a certain area of the world. If you could only be a journalist, or only live in East Africa, which would you choose?" I expected Jeff to pick journalism. He didn't. "Look, journalism is a great fit for me. I've always gravitated towards writing. I've always been okay being in new situations. Even the confrontational side of journalism, that speaks to my personality. I like to challenge authority. But I think journalism has been, in a sense, a means to an end." Jeff's passion emerged over a period of years. And it wasn't just a process of passive discovery, of unearthing a little gem hidden inside his psyche, but rather of active construction. Jeff didn't just go looking for his passion, he helped create it. Moving to Ithaca, New York from Evanston, Illinois, Jeff at 18 years old could not have predicted his future career. At Cornell, he ended up majoring in philosophy, in part because, quote, "it was the easiest to fulfill the requirements," end quote. Then, the summer after freshman year, he visited East Africa, and that was the beginning of the beginning. Quote, "I don't know how to explain it. This place just blew my mind. There was a spirit here that I wanted to connect with, and I wanted to make it a part of my life," unquote. As soon as he got back to Cornell, Jeff started taking courses in Swahili, and after sophomore year, he took a year off to backpack around the world. During that trip, he returned to East Africa, experiencing the same wonder he'd felt the first time he visited. Still, it wasn't clear how he'd make a life there. How did he hit on journalism as a career path? A professor who admired Jeff's writing suggested as much, and Jeff remembers thinking, "That's the dumbest idea I'd heard. Who wants to work for a boring newspaper?" I remember thinking the same thing once about becoming a professor. Who wants to be a boring professor? Eventually, Jeff did work for the student paper, the Cornell Daily Sun, but as a photographer, not a writer. "When I got to Oxford," he told me, "I was pretty lost academically. It was shocking to the Oxford professors that I didn't really know what I wanted to do. They were like, 'Why are you here? This is a serious place. You should have a firm sense of what you want to study, or you shouldn't be here.'" My guess at the time was that Jeff would pursue photojournalism. He reminded me of Robert Kincaid, the worldly wise photographer played by Clint Eastwood in The Bridges of Madison County, which was released around the time we became friends. In fact, I can still remember the photographs Jeff showed me 20 years ago. I thought they were from National Geographic, but he'd actually taken them himself. By his second year at Oxford, he figured out that journalism was an even better fit. "Once I learned more about being a journalist and how that could get me back to Africa, and how that actually would be fun, and I could write more creatively than I first imagined journalism was, then I was like, screw it, this is what I'm going to do." I set out a very deliberate path that was possible because the journalism industry was very hierarchical, and it was clear how to get from A to B to C to D, etc. Step A was writing for Oxford's student newspaper, Cherwell. Step B was a summer internship at a small paper in Wisconsin. Step C was the St. Petersburg Times in Florida, on the Metro beat. Step D was the Los Angeles Times. Step E was the New York Times as a national correspondent in Atlanta. Step F was being sent overseas to cover war stories, and, in 2006, just over a decade since he'd set himself the goal, he finally reached Step G, becoming the New York Times East Africa bureau chief. "It was a really winding road that took me to all kinds of places," Jeff explained, And it was difficult and discouraging and demoralizing and scary and all the rest. But eventually, I got here. I got exactly where I wanted to be.